All right, this was an exciting week on Twitter. This kind of drove me insane. I'm starting to think that, like, the politics are so bad. I don't even know if this is a real person. Obviously, a real person must have typed this, but this is what it said. This was the tweet. I pulled my two kids. I don't know why there's a hashtag at two kids out of hashtag public school in hashtag second grade and hashtag paid a mint for hashtag private school until all caps hashtag homeschooled their last hashtag 2 years. Someone needs remedial hashtagging class because this is ridiculous. As a stand, so this person is taking a stand in all capitals against school policies, again, hashtag angry face. And then it goes on, this might be the greatest tweet ever. I'd never, all caps, put my kids, all caps, in school if they had to hashtag wear a mask. Never, exclamation point. Grow a pair, people, hashtagged, and hashtag MAGA. Now look, I get the idea that you don't want government telling you what to do with your face. I mean, there's a lot worse things that you could do with your face that doesn't involve a mask. And thankfully, it's just a mask. But okay, I get the argument that, you know, as a libertarian or conservative, you don't want the government telling you what to do with your face. Fine. But it's a mask and it kind of helps. And even if you didn't believe in it yourself, if other people believe in it, just as a courtesy, you do it. It's not such a big deal. You go into a store and you do it. And it's fine. It really is. Now, if this was all that happened in this particular tweet, I'd be fine with it. But then it goes on. It posts this crazy meme that I guess is going around. This is the only place I saw it, where it's this giant, like, protective mask with like all these breathing apparatuses. And it says, this is the mask needed to prevent virus, misspelled, inhalation and absorption through the eyes. And then it has the little mask that all of us wear, the medical mask. And it says, obey sheeple, which for those who aren't in the Twitter know, that means sheep people. See, I figured that out all by myself. This is a mind control device, part of a pandemic psyop. So there's a bunch of these conspiracy people around who think that there's some kind of giant government plot going on to get people to wear masks and then control them and God knows what else. There's so many dumb people, so many dumb people. And this tweet, I have to tell you, at the time that I saw it, was pretty much my last straw. I said, you know what? Maybe the internet is not for me. Maybe having eyeballs is not for me. Maybe I'm just not meant to be in this society. And then I realized, you know what? I think it's time for China to take over. They have to. And that's exactly what I did. This is what I tweeted. I said, it's time to shut it down. We had a good run. Didn't work out. Keep the tattoos and the bumper stickers. Those are our consolation prizes. But the rest, it's over. So then I started to tweet only in Chinese to represent our rightful rulers. My first statement in Mandarin was, we surrender. My next statement was, we will provide your mail for free. They have an excellent post office in China. Excellent. Next tweet, freedom is overrated. We have free medical care. We guarantee to provide you with factory work. Good jobs. Good jobs. Bernie would love it. The next one is, everyone here is wearing a mask. We stop epidemics. We also start them sometimes. Forget the last part, that it is in order. We have the best comedy club. Another word we use for comedy is freedom of speech. All your future tweets must use the language of the liberator. All Chinese tattoos purchased by Americans are bat recipes. And finally, it will be painless. That's fresh from our new Chinese overlords. Someone's going to take this thing over, because if we're getting this stupid and this obtuse, what hope is there? I don't know. This really bummed me out, so I thought I would start the show with this. There was a very glowing article on NPR about ClassPass and how the woman who started it, you know, how they're doing a great job weathering the pandemic. Now, in case you don't know what ClassPass is, ClassPass is one of these middleman startups where they want you to book exercise classes through them, and then you can go to any one of these different participating gyms. It's almost exactly like Grubhub, but for being in shape. So you order your Grubhub and you grow, you know, man boobs, and then you join ClassPass to get rid of them. Anyway, what bothered me about reading this article is that these middlemen that are funded by venture capital, I don't know that we should be celebrating them right now. When you're able to raise hundreds of millions of dollars from other people to be a middleman, where everyone else who participates in your company and makes your company viable has to take out loans, has to have capital expenditures on, you know, equipment and real estate, and has to pay a bunch of instructors. So they're doing the hard work of operating a business on very thin, tiny margins, and now non-existent margins because all the gyms are closed. And then, you know, these guys, oh, we weathered the storm. Yeah, because you're a middleman. And you don't have to put any of the same risk on the table. And so, I don't know, it just bothers me for some reason. Maybe I shouldn't get this worked up about it. But, you know, there's a bunch of these companies that are inserting themselves into the customer relationship between the customer and all of these different small businesses. And they're taking the fat part of the profit, or you would think it would be profit, but they're still selling the services too cheap to make any money. And they still go public for billions of dollars. It's really an insane Ponzi scheme. I don't know if it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a scheme of some sort where basically, you know, all these investors pile in, overvalue the thing, and sometimes someone acquires it, and other times they go public, and, you know, the public markets have to bear the cost. But just celebrating this right now when so many of the businesses that make these middlemen possible are struggling drove me nuts. It just hit a nerve. I don't know. You could tell me if that makes sense or not. So I thought of this quote, and we've heard it all probably from when we were children. If you don't like the outcome, then change it. But suddenly that same quote has a couple of different meanings. So the meaning that I grew up with is change yourself, try harder, and then you can succeed. And maybe you'll get the outcome you want. But the way politics are going, and the way just people are culturally now, it's try harder to change the rules, and then you can get the outcome you want. And I get it, you know, maybe some of the rules aren't fair, but it is such a disempowering message. And I don't just internally feel very comfortable with it, because I think it paralyzes people. And I guess time is going to tell if the rules were really unfair or if we're opening the gates to idiocracy. And I hope it's not the latter, but I just see a lot of people claiming everything's unfair and externalizing everything and taking very little accountability over the power that they have over their own lives. And that, I think, is a very negative thing to do. It corrupts the soul and it paralyzes people. We'll see if I'm right or wrong. Okay, so this was interesting. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull this up, but there was a crazy demo of a Rolls Royce, this new Rolls Royce. Let me see if I can open this.
All right, inside, this is actually a heated compartment to dry your umbrellas faster. walk into the car. You don't have to duck, because of course that's not very luxurious. That's what they're aiming for. No steering wheel. This car is fully autonomous. Now, what you could say is Rolls-Royce has been, from the very beginning, an autonomous car, because they were made to be chauffeur-driven. So you were always
look at this. It's
kind of hanging back here in luxury and comfort. Look, you've got silk pillows, a silk lounge chair here in the back. You've got hand-woven woolen carpet. It's all going to be controlled with artificial intelligence.
If you're listening to this and not watching,
oh, hi.
You can step into it, and it looks wild. Anyway, I'm not going to, it's very hard to continue. So I'm going to pause this for a second. But it made me think about the perception of rich people that we had when I was a kid. You know, like rich people were like richy rich. They, you know, had these giant cars. They had these, they had chauffeurs. No one drove, right? Rolls Royce wasn't for driving. Rolls Royce was for someone driving you. And you had this sort of image in your mind. And now the public discourse is all about taking down rich people. And even Bernie Sanders, like the millionaires and the billionaires. And then he changed his tune once he became a millionaire, and he narrowed it down to just billionaires, the billionaires and the, oh, wait a minute, that's me. And he stopped talking about millionaires. And, you know, it's kind of funny that all of the billionaires now kind of disguise their wealth. Like if you saw Mark Cuban walking down the street and you didn't know who he was, or you saw Mark Zuckerberg walking down the street and you didn't know who he was, they're all wearing like, I don't know, Banana Republic clothes. Would you know who they are? Would you know that they're worth billions of dollars? And it's funny how a lot of the technology even we have access to, like even the ability to do this live, is insane. And so we have all of these superpowers. We have stuff that rich people would have killed for. And I mean literally killed for back in the day, available to us. And yet we're mostly indistinguishable. There are occasions where, you know, you see them doing some crazy stuff on Instagram and you're like, oh, that guy gets to throw models off a roof into his giant pool. By the way, there's a guy who does that, Dan Bilzerian. I don't know what his exact last name is, but he got in trouble for that. I think one of the girls he threw off the roof broke her leg. Anyway, so there's this weird juxtaposition between just crazy displays of wealth, like yachts and, you know, models flying into pools, and then and these kinds of cars. And then there's this other world where these guys dress exactly like the rest of us, and it's kind of schizophrenic. And we do have access to some of these things, and I wonder, you know, what that does to the sentiment, right? You know, because you get resentful, or a lot of people get resentful over what billionaires have. And now people are saying there shouldn't even be billionaires. And the question is, how close to their lives would we have to be or live in order to just go, ah, screw it, I don't care that they're billionaires. So I don't know. The math doesn't really work. We could take all their money and distribute it, and it wouldn't even make a difference, because there's just not enough of money in their hands. But I think we just feel bad when we see these things. I think social media allows us to see all these things. Because if you have a Datsun, okay, there's no such thing as a Datsun anymore, but if you have a Nissan and you look at this video, you're like, man, what am I doing wrong? Anyway. So I was looking up ways to do video editing, and then this guy had a video posted on how to carve out your frame in a window. And then I looked at his video explaining it, and this was the cutout. And for those of you who are listening instead of watching, it is not the best job. And I'm like, maybe this is not the man for the job. Anyway. Just a funny thing I thought I'd share. So this was going around, that another dumb meme for dumb people. We really have a serious education problem in this country. So this is a statistical thing that happened. Here you have a meme that says media polls lie. And the guy who posted it, which he's a verified guy, said, or it might be a woman, Joe. Oh, Joe without the E is a woman. Okay. Said, I've been told that a poll of 787 people is more accurate than a poll of 15,000. And then that emoji, basically shrugging the shoulders. And yeah, that's basic statistical analysis. So statistical analysis beyond a certain sample size really gets hard to increase accuracy. What's more important is having a representative sample size. So you can have a bunch of people, for example, responding to an internet poll, let's say an MSNBC, and you can have 5 million people respond to it. And it will be the most inaccurate thing on earth because it's only people who go to that website and likely people who share a certain opinion, and all of them are online and all of them share a bunch of similar characteristics. So you've done no work in creating a representative population. So these online polls are all worthless. And even the polling companies that do good statistical sampling, or at least correct statistical sampling, suck, because realistically, who's picking up the phone? Who's answering polls? Who has got this kind of time on their hands? So I don't know what kind of magic you can perform, but it's extremely hard to get accurate sampling. And then another person posted, she's a reporter, someone, you know, who's posted respectful investigative pieces. And she said the same thing. Why can't they sample more than 700 people? And this was just from a basic statistics class. At some point, what matters most is not the size of the sample, which that's what she said. Anyway, my Michael Scott joke, which I'm sure is probably taboo or Me Too these days. And what really matters is how you choose the groups that you're going to sample. And here's the proof for it. So this guy wrote a post, and I'm just focusing on the second bullet point here, where basically you're going to have to sometimes quadruple the sample in order to just budge the margin at all. And he posted a chart. So basically saying that once you get to a sample of 500 to 700, your margin of error is plus or minus 4%. To get it to 3%, you have to go to like 800, 900, and even going to 2000 only drops it to plus or minus 2. So again, you know, 700 is a very good number for a statistical sample. And everyone's got to take a statistical course. You know, this is something that we're desperately failing at. There is no analytical thinking happening at all anywhere. And that's why we have the society that we have. That's why people are making retarded mask memes, because no one understands just basic critical thinking and statistical thinking and problem solving. I don't know. Another thing that drove me nuts. I should stay off the internet because it drives me insane. All right, let's keep going. Okay, listen. I bought this prepackaged bread. There was nothing else. They didn't have any fresh bread at Target. I needed to make a sandwich. Can we stop including the end pieces? Who are we fooling here? We're going to pretend that this came out of some, you know, amazing oven and was fresh baked and not some laboratory at, I don't know, Kellogg's or something, or where whoever owns Arnold bread. Neither of us, when I'm picking up that bread, neither me nor the company nor the supermarket is paying tribute to the culinary history of Europe and, you know, the bakers of yore. This is, I'm buying a delivery vehicle for peanut butter. That's it. That's all it is. So let's stop pretending and let's stop including those end pieces. This is a free consultation to bread companies, who, and I know many bread executives watch this show. This, in fact, like 60% of my audience, I looked at the numbers, is bread executives. I mean, there's a few peanut butter executives and a few Kellogg's, you know, granola bar people, but you know, they're second class citizens. These are, I'm speaking to the bakers now. Let's go on. Okay, another lesson for a company, Intel. This was the post for one of the computers that was on sale. 1.8 gigahertz, which, you know, I know what that is, but a lot of people don't. 10th generation, so now I need to know all of your generations. Intel Core i7, I know what that is, but I'm a techie. And then the model number, 10510U. Okay, it's time for an intervention. We have to stop this, okay? Because 8 alphanumeric numbers for your product number is too many. It's too many. No one on earth, or at least no one in the first world, has memorized a phone number in the last 15 to 20 years. You're going to tell us we have to learn your 8-digit or alphanumeric whatever product codes? It's insanity. I bet you your sales go up by 20% the minute we understand what the hell we're buying. So come up with names like iPhone 10 or whatever, something simple that people can relate to and understand what they're buying. And it's not unique to Intel. A lot of manufacturers, and I've consulted to a lot of Asian electronics manufacturers all over the world, and they do not use basic common sense, the sprawl of model numbers, incomprehensible nonsense. I posted something from, I was looking at printers. I went to Canon's website. They have model numbers. And not only that, they expect you to know their series, which are as incomprehensible as the model numbers. It's almost comical if they weren't a real company and expecting to make real sales. It's really, it drove me nuts. Like there's no way to navigate a site when you first have to pick a series and you don't know any of the series. Sorry, I wasn't in your boardroom when you came up with 40 different series of products and I didn't memorize the hierarchy in order to be able to shop on your website. The nonsense they put you through. And it goes across the board. So these companies, aside from the product names, have way too many SKUs, which is the same thing as model numbers. You have to pare it down. People are not that different all over the world. It would be so much cheaper, so much more efficient to have a few good model numbers instead of a lot of crappy ones. And there's just, I call it feature vomit. It's like, hey, let's throw a bunch of stuff against the wall, stuff that people will never use. Samsung loads up their phones with all kinds of duplicate features and just features that are novelties that you'll never use. And the only thing you do is look for ways to shut it off. And, you know, it's just a lack of market focus and lack of segment focus. And, you know, and then there's the bad software, which a lot of these companies aren't good at. They're okay at the hardware, but a lot of them are terrible at the software, and the service is non-existent. If they focused on the experience and the service and the design, then they might have some success. Japan is dead. And I'm not talking about just because of their aging population, but Japan is dead in terms of industry. They're dead because they allowed their companies to become obsolete. There is no innovation happening there. When was the last time you walked into a store looking for something from Sony or Panasonic? When I used to sell electronics, I used to sell electronics at Radio Shack and all these other places, and people would come in and they would be asking for Sony receivers or Sony TVs. And I had the job of convincing them to buy an Optimus, which is the house brand for Radio Shack or Tandy Corporation at the time. So, you know, it's insanity. Like, I had the hardest job in the world and I did it and I kicked ass as a salesperson. But the burden you're putting on people when your brands have no pull. Pull is when people ask for it. Push is what they're doing now, which is shoving a bunch of stuff out the door and throwing model after model at the wall, hoping one of them sticks. And they're diminishing their brands too. Like Samsung puts the Galaxy name on everything, on a bunch of crappy phones. If you want Galaxy to be upscale, make sure only the Galaxy series, the Note and the S, are the only ones that get the name. Call the other ones, you know, something smaller, like solar system, or, you know, near Earth orbit, or satellite, you know, something more demure, not something gigantic. And Chinese manufacturers are actually outdoing the Japanese ones. They're learning. They're looking at companies like Apple and so on. Like there's a company in the mobile space called OnePlus. And they're, I think, on their eighth or ninth generation phone. And they're actually pretty good. They get really good buzz. There's a group of people who looks forward to their features and releases. And it's you know, they're doing well. And Huawei is the biggest manufacturer still in the world, even though they're sort of banned in the US. I don't know what the final situation is. Anyway, Chinese companies are actually learning fast. That's what they do. They copy. They're really good at copying, and then they're starting to innovate. You know, so once you get the basics down, it's like the Picasso example I used in a previous episode. You know, once you learn to paint that bowl of fruit, now you're able to do, you know, improv and do more creative things. And a lot of it comes down to management. You know, these organizations are so top down. People are afraid. They're afraid. Oh my God, I had this one situation at a Japanese manufacturer where the guy who was our project sponsor got reamed. I mean, reamed by his foreign bosses in front of everybody. It was horrible. It was horrible. And super entertaining. It was really fun to watch, but I was a little too close to it. It's only fun in retrospect. When I was there, it was like shocking. It was like one of those moments when you see a fight and you sort of clam up and you get all defensive and tight. And that's kind of what happened. And if that happened to me, I wouldn't be surprised if the other guy peed his pants. I mean, I didn't check, but if he did, I wouldn't be surprised. And it's because of this culture that it's very hard for good ideas to filter up. And this happens in other organizations, not just in Asia, but they just historically have been that way. And there's also an eagerness to please that happens. And I, you know, maybe I'll do this example. I'm already getting too wrapped up. You know what? I'm going to do this example in the Patreon episode because I'm already spending too much time on this. Let's keep going. Basically, just so you know what it is, I wrote an open letter to LG about their mobile phones and what they should do about it. Anyway, so if you're interested, I'm going to put this on the Patreon. Let's keep going. All right, language. I have seen language shaming. Yeah, that's right. I just invented a new type of shaming. I know you thought the social justice warriors had the market cornered. Oh, no. Oh, no. I am playing this game, too. And language shaming is what people do when they judge others for either not knowing a second language or not having traveled to other countries and so on. And, you know, look, I may not enjoy talking to someone who hasn't at least had some curiosity about the world as much as I would someone who has, but that's, you know, that's a personal choice, but I'm not going to judge them as a lesser person. And for a very simple reason, language is a survival skill. You learn it because you have to. So when you live in Europe and you live in a country where you drive 100 or 200 miles in either direction, and you can go through two or three countries, of course you need to know a second language, and possibly a third and a fourth, because your life, your survival is directly impacted by those other countries and cultures. And so, you know, if you drove from New York to Massachusetts, and they spoke Massachusetts, C's, okay, whatever that is, you know, and they kind of do have a language. They have that weird accent, Boston. Yeah. What do they say? Chowda. Anyway, so that could easily have gone much further to the point where we don't even understand them. And if you have to, you will do it. If you have to travel, you will do it. So you don't get to celebrate something that either was a necessity and lorded over people's heads, or if you were born rich and were able to travel and had the money to travel. And that's not to say you couldn't travel if you're poor. You absolutely can. I've seen people without any money backpacking through all different countries, Asia, Europe, everywhere. I traveled a lot, didn't have much money. All you have to do is sometimes you have to get a job either before to save up or while you go to all these different places. I saw so many people waiting on tables and doing like little tours and other stuff just as a side hustle to make enough money so they could eat and afford a hostel. It can work. So On one hand, yes, I encourage everyone to travel and everyone to learn another language. But also, I don't encourage people to judge others on that basis. Right. So Britain is about to, this was the, you know, the Telegraph and all these publications write these doom and gloom headlines. It's not as doomy as it sounds, but the reality is that when you're in debt, much of your income goes towards servicing that debt, right? So you can't go on trips. You can't do all this stuff because you've borrowed a bunch of money and you have to pay it back. Now, same thing happens in countries, right? You take out a bunch of money and the creditors want repayment. The US is kind of in a special position because we could print a lot of money, but that doesn't stop the problem because the value of each individual dollar decreases. So everyone is getting poorer. And that burden doesn't land on baby boomers. That burden doesn't even land on whatever the other generations are called, Gen X, or, you know, it's going to land on millennials and Gen Z and whatever the next one, Gen, what comes after Z? Do we go back to A again? Anyway, and then you can't fund growth. You don't have enough capital to fund growth. And especially if interest rates rise because you're a higher risk, then more and more of your money has to go towards servicing debt. That leaves less money for investment. So if you want to invest in clean technologies, you want to invest in some kind of R&D for, you know, different industries or whatever it is, new satellite technologies, you can't. You just can't. Or if you want to help people start businesses, any program you want to do will be affected, if not crippled, by higher debt. So this is not a freebie. When we talk about helping people with paychecks or unemployment, I absolutely think we should, but we should also understand the consequences. So maybe we should be a little bit smarter of how to deploy that money. And I know there's limits because a lot of states don't even have the ability to target that money very effectively or to even do certain calculations. Anyway, there's no free rides. And in some ways, it relates to this other tweet I did, which is, even if you're not religious, get on your hands and knees every day and thank whoever it is. Honestly, you have to thank Germany. Because if not for World War II, we would not be the reserve currency of the world. And that's realistically the only thing keeping this economy and this country afloat. It allows us to be as irresponsible with money and expenditures as we are. Because if we couldn't print money the way we do, and if all these countries didn't hold dollars or hold all of their investments in dollars, we would be screwed. So we're in a better position than most, but we have to start fixing this because the analogy I gave is it's like OPEC, right? We made OPEC irrelevant. How did we do it? By creating our own engine of creating energy, of fracking. I know I'm not a big fan of fracking. A lot of people aren't big fans of fracking. But the reality is it has made this country a net exporter of energy. We no longer have to rely on these horrible regimes in order to get oil, which is, for now and for a long time coming, is essential to our economy. It's essential. There's no getting away from it. You're not going to windmill your way to clean energy. The reality is we still need oil, and fracking has allowed us to become independent of these horrible regimes. And it's the same thing that we have to do. We've become so dependent on printed and borrowed money that we don't even know how to make a budget anymore. We don't even know how to prioritize anymore. We don't know that investment in our health, investment in R&D, investment in just the growth of our economy and small business and education, these are investments for the future. We don't know how to make them. We know how to buy bombs and we know how to borrow. And we have a bunch of welfare programs that are spotty at best. I was out somewhere and I saw a cop playing with a phone and clearly not paying attention to what was going on. And then I looked over and then there was a guy who was, loading baggage. and he was wearing headphones. And I had the thought, I'm like, imagine a world where all the work that was done with headphones playing or with people holding phones in one hand was redone without the headphones and without the phone. Can you imagine how much better and more spectacular our world would be if people were not distracted? Oh, so now there are black markets for exercise because people want gyms and they've been forced to be closed. So now all these people are going to these clandestine gyms all over the country. And that's the reality. Bans lead to black markets. They always have. And they always will for most things, especially if the demand is high enough. And I encourage you, if you hear anything, that you help stop the yoga to prison pipeline. That's one of the greatest threats to this country. And there's a lot of COVID being spread there. And even worse, these people are going to come out of this pandemic in shape while we get fat. This cannot be allowed. We need to stop them. So report, snitch, do what you do on social media and get these people out of the gyms and into the Slim Jims or into the Bob's Big Boy or McDonald's or wherever it is that we can make sure that they plump up just like the rest of us. All right, let's keep going. So, okay, this is interesting. So there's a company called Product Hunt, where people post all of their new technology ideas or products. And there's one called Meet From Home, which is a way to replace real-world networking. And I got to tell you, let's do an intervention about networking in general. First of all, even under the best of circumstances, when you're networking face-to-face and you go to some event, the people you want to network with are not there. There's just nothing in it for them. They're not there. So you're networking with other people who, you know, need stuff. And it's 1,000 times more for online events. It's way worse. And typically, even in a real world event, maybe 40% of the time, you have an interesting conversation. 10% of the time, you might make a friend or an interesting acquaintance. 1% of the time, you could get a date. Although, if you're looking for opposite sex dates, some of these tech mixers are not very good for that. And maybe there's 0.5%, maybe 1%, where you could get sort of a low-level introduction, which is a lukewarm introduction, not really a good one. Still, the best type of networking, if you're looking to meet strangers, are daytime events where they're content driven. So there's a topic that attracts people who are curious about it. And realistically, there's just no alternative for that yet. No digital alternative. So this is going to suffer. I mean, your ability to meet strangers who can help you is going to suffer over the next however many months or even years. And just to go one level deeper, the reason networking events don't work is that substantive interactions require three things: context, stakes, and upside. And I'll explain each one. First, context. You have to have something to bond you together, to have a reason why you're there. So common interests, goals, or maybe you were brought together by circumstances. Maybe, you know, your company implemented some new technology and you need to learn about it so you don't get fired or you look good at work. Stakes. When you get a warm introduction from somebody who knows you, and it doesn't go well, that can negatively affect your reputation. And if it goes really well, it could positively affect your reputation. So everyone has something at stake, and you don't want to make the person who made the introduction look bad either. So there's something in it for everybody. But when you're complete strangers, there's no bond like that. There are no stakes. You know, things don't work out. Someone burns you. Who cares? You don't know any of their friends. They don't know any of your friends. It's done. And finally, upside. all parties have to perceive that they have comparable upside, whether it's tangible or intangible. So intangible could be something like, you know, maybe I love mentoring young people. So I would go to an event where there's a lot of young people and find myself someone to mentor. So that's not a tangible thing. I won't get, you know, money out of it or a new company or a new business partner, but it's, you know, it's valuable to me. So there are those cases, but they're still not going to these events. And realistically, most networking events are a taker on taker crime. You can't have two people show up both expecting to take and walk away with something meaningful. And there are strategies that work. So I've had a few interns who do this. I called it the hopper strategy. And there's a few people have done that. So basically you pitch somebody that you admire, would want to work for, or would like their career at some point in the future. And even though you don't have the experience, you focus on one, maybe two specific areas where you can help them. And you propose it to them and hopefully they take you up on it. And you might end up with someone who is, a good gateway into your new future. And if you stay long enough to do a good job, that person will recommend you. You'll build a relationship. You'll build recommendation. You'll build endorsements. You'll maybe have an ecosystem of people you've worked with through them who you'll also relate to. But you have to stay long enough to do that. If you just try to hop too soon, then you look like a user and no one wants to deal with you. And you can repeat this process multiple times. You can go from one to the other. I know a guy who worked for me, did this, and now he's getting paid to book podcasts professionally. So, you know, it works, but you can't make it super transactional. There has to be value, there has to be depth, and it has to be authentic. And you also have to be realistic about your ability to execute, your time commitment, and your level of interest that can keep you going through something that realistically will probably be free, or at least your labor will be free. So you have to make sure that it's something you really want. And at the very least, you have to look good. You have to come away looking good. So even if you start to hate this thing, you have to give it enough of a chance and be a professional and walk away. Even if you don't pursue that career, you have to walk away on good terms. And this is realistically how fake it till you make it really works in real life. And it's not that different from a job, except you're doing it for free. It's all your grit. You're creating it out of thin air. You're not getting paid, and you're starting with your passion instead of, you know, what posting is available somewhere online. And the other big difference is you're taking a reason for them to say no out of the equation, because money is friction, right? If someone has to create a new job opening, or if they have to pay you, which is something maybe they weren't planning on doing, but it's something that you want because you're offering your help, then you're eliminating a very important barrier. And I realize not everyone can afford to do this, but you know, the people I know weren't rolling in cash who did this, and they found a way. Just like with travel, the travel example I gave earlier, people find a way. And it's not easy. And there are some who have way worse disadvantages, but that's life. And you got to work through it. No one's going to help you out through that. This guy posted an interesting tweet. Private businesses are fighting to reopen, and public schools are fighting to remain closed. There's truth to that. And I have mixed feelings about it, but it didn't stop me from posting this meme, which is a teacher shopping for groceries, and she's thinking, thank God one of us has an essential job. And realistically, that's where we are. And I did a whole rant on this on the Patreon episode. So if you want to go to patreon.com/McFuture, you can check that out. But it is kind of an interesting place for us to be. And if you look at countries like Germany and South Korea, they were able to reopen schools, and some of them didn't even shut them down. They just kept them open because they were able to implement really good, thoughtful procedures during the pandemic. and even during the lockdowns. But this is the thing. We're trapped inside of a huge government, for lack of a better term, fuck up. This didn't have to happen. There were five things that needed to be done during the quarantine. First, enable contact tracing so we have some system of knowing who's infected and who's not. Second, we needed to make testing super available and super cheap and everywhere, something you can do constantly. And we need to figure out a way to protect people who are vulnerable. Let them, you know, identify themselves maybe, or find a way for them to, you know, get housing or something, or certain protections that others don't have. Get even PPE equipment to them. Virus-proofing indoor spaces. And also the last one, number five, is promoting healthy habits. I know it's tough. I mean, clearly, look at me. You know, I'm eating. But diet, exercise, supplements, at the very least I'm doing those, are so important. And anyone who knows anything about health will tell you they make a difference. Those things make you more resistant to all kinds of infections. And no one's talking about it. Everyone, again, as a society, we're pawning everything off on everyone else, taking very little accountability. And that takes me to this bigger point, which is the importance of culture. Culture is so different from country to country. You can't just transplant what happened in Europe and plop it into the United States, what happened in Germany and move it to the US or to any particular state, or what South Korea did. The cultures are so different. And we can learn from it, but whatever the solution we ultimately implement has to be our own. Because going back to that first tweet that I showed you, that woman who posted about, you know, the conspiracy of masks, the reality is she's out there. She's shopping. She's driving. She's doing all kinds of things that should probably be illegal for her to do, but she's doing them. And we need to deal with her. And we need to deal with millions of others that are, you know, paranoid on the left or on the right or whatever end of the spectrum. Somehow this thing got politicized. But the reality is the culture is different. And it's the same thing with healthcare policy. Our starting point is different. Our budget is different. Our size is different. So much is different. So we can learn from other countries, but we can't copy them. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, if you look at Asian cultures in general, they're into planning and thinking long term. They consider others and sacrifice for the common good. They wear masks even when no one's asking them to wear masks. You go even on the New York subway system and you'll see Japanese tourists wearing masks. You know, and a lot of it is out of politeness, so they don't cough on you. And they take smart, calculated risks. They're not just going to sit home. They know they have to work. A lot of them have even less savings than the average American. They have to go out and work, but they're taking calculated risks. And the group dynamic actually helps that. And they also have diligence and they follow instructions. So if the government says to do something, they do it. And that's what happens in high trust society. Scandinavia and the Nordic countries are the same way. People trust their government. People trust their leaders. And in those high trust societies, people will follow orders. Here, we don't have that level of trust. So we have to design solutions that work around it until we earn that trust. And we haven't. In fact, I think it's been deteriorating. Yeah, and there's a bunch of these rich guys like Mark Benioff, who's a brilliant entrepreneur, but he's been posting about masks and why can't people wear the masks. And I'll tell you a little story. I went to Brooklyn to have drinks and dinner with some people, a bunch of Russians, basically. Not a mask in sight. Nowhere. Not the waiters, not the staff, no, none of the guests. Everyone was talking this close to your face. Nothing. No way. It's like none of this ever happened. And it was sort of outside. It was kind of enclosed, but, you know, it was outdoors-ish. And people were not distancing. It was just, you know, it didn't matter. No one was cleansing their hands or doing any of that stuff. So how do you control that? How do you do that? I couldn't control it. And I'm paranoid about this stuff. I've had health issues. So I can't be, you know, just prancing around going to these things where people are just completely unhinged and uncontrollable. And so now you have to become a little bit more paranoid. But that's the reality. That's what we're dealing with culturally. And you're not just going to change it by shaming people. You're just not. So all that condescension, put it away. It's not going to work. You have to find another way. You have to appeal to people's ego sometimes, to their care for other people, and to their better self. And everyone has it. I know it's easy to say that, you know, all of these people don't have a better self. They do. Everyone does. Everyone loves their dog, hopefully. Hitler loved his dog. That's what they tell me. He probably shot it at some point when they were coming. I don't know that. Yeah, and we just get caught up in these bubbles. We end up secluding ourselves either online or offline with a bunch of people that are just like us, whether, you know, super educated and elitist or people who are working class. And it starts to reinforce itself, all the good and the bad ideas. And it also disables you from being able to communicate with other people because you don't have any empathy anymore because you don't rub elbows with different people. Yeah, maybe at the service counter somewhere, but not meaningful personal social interactions. You know, I kind of broke it down into four types of people that are involved in the mask debate or the pro and anti-lockdown debate. So the first type is the pragmatist. Realistically, these are people who can't Zoom all day. They have to work. And you know who they are if you do Zoom, because they're the people in the stores working when you're still at home doing whatever, work from home. So those are just pragmatic people and they need a way to make a living. So they want to get back to work and you can't shame them for it. You can't belittle them for it. The next is the conformists, and these are people who are typically good students who are very eager to follow a scientist, any scientist, and they will follow them into the abyss, even if they're wrong. But these are cautious rule followers, and I would say a lot of the people that I went to college with are that. And then there's the heretics, and these are the divergent thinkers who are trying to come up with new ways and new solutions to solve this thing. And a lot of the startup people are that way. And, you know, you have to maybe hear them out because, you know, the initial reaction, oh, no, we must listen, we must conform, we must listen. No, the people who built the big companies of all the products that we use, the people who got the rockets into space, the people who did a lot of the things that we enjoy the benefits of, those people were iconoclasts. They were not great students. They dropped out or were kicked out or whatever. So it does make sense to listen, even if it hurts, even if every muscle and nerve in your body contorts and tries to reject what they're saying because it differs from what others are saying that you believe because they're scientists and they have a little plaque on the wall. And then there's the partisans and the pawns, people who are manipulating these things for political reasons. And yeah, I can't prove that people want to extend lockdowns just to make Trump look worse. And I can't prove that, you know, Trump is doing certain things to make, whatever his side of the, I can't even figure out what his side is half the time. But the reality is there's a bunch of really smart political operators that are using these as wedge issues. And quite frankly, the media is doing it too, because they know their bread is buttered with conflict. So the more conflict we have, the more people click, the more engagement they get. So it's kind of in their interest. And I don't know that I love that world. So Comedy Central is canceling a bunch of shows that film live, and they're trying to move more to cartoons. And it's kind of funny to me because I think Comedy Central is becoming to comedy what MTV is to music. MTV, for those who don't know, the M stands for music. And they used to have music videos, and I guess people stopped watching and they started evolving into Real World and all that other, you know, junk TV. I have no idea what's on MTV right now. If you asked me, I couldn't even guess the type of show that they put on their network now. I have no idea what's on it or how their branding even makes sense anymore. And I've seen a lot of Comedy Central. My God. I mean, you can't put political correctness as an overlay on a comedy network. Comedy, by definition, tests boundaries. It is sometimes wrong or very wrong, and that's why we laugh. And so if you start to project all this corporate conservatism and all of these woke politics into these networks, that's the fastest way to kill them. And I'm fine with that because there's so many great comedians and performers and people on YouTube and all these other platforms. I'm never going to miss it. In fact, the reason I don't know what's on Comedy Central anymore, or mostly, and MTV, is because there's so much great entertainment, so many creative people, and they're just throwing it out there. And yeah, sometimes it flops big, but you got to give them a wide berth to try things out. And that's what we're missing. We're like, you know, grinding it out of our society. The opponent to Vladimir Putin, his name is Alexei Navalny. I'm saying it with the American pronunciation. He was supposedly poisoned by somebody and he, I guess, passed out and was taken to the hospital. I haven't seen what his latest condition is. Hopefully he'll be okay. But what people don't understand, having come from communism and having come from that environment, I don't think Americans can really appreciate what a society with zero constraints on wealth and power actually looks like. It is pure lawlessness. And even if you manage to build something, it can be taken away from you at a moment's notice. Someone doesn't like you, you fall out of political favor, you say something wrong, someone more powerful has something against you, you lose everything, if not your life. And I don't think people understand, by the way, and that's why Russia can never be great, ever. They have such a level of distrust in authority and such a breakdown in basic rule of law. They just don't have it. I mean, cops can basically hold you up for money. And same thing with Mexico, same thing with all these third world countries. You go there and you are in a war zone. You are in warlord land or whatever it is. It's not quite that because it has sort of the look and feel of a normal cosmopolitan place, but don't be fooled. The reality is it is deeply and profoundly corrupt. And we get our Epsteins here too, but just the frequency, the magnitude, and just the degree of difficulty of getting away with stuff here, you have no idea how much better it is here. And all the people who complain about this country, I really encourage you to go overseas. Try to exercise the same rights to protest that you've exercised here without real fear of the federal government or whatever. Yes, there are situations that are very ugly and should be taken care of. But generally speaking, I don't think you understand what it would be like to organize a protest in 70% of countries in the world, including democracies. And I mentioned before, I take vitamin D, C, and zinc. Have never gotten the COVID, thank God. Never been poisoned by Putin. So there. All right. This was interesting. Oh, man. I got to get through these. This came out. Half of singles are not looking for a relationship or dates. We've poisoned ourselves. There are three things that are poisoning our society. And it's reflected in our youth. Unfortunately, they're the most impressionable. And they're on the front lines of what our future will look like. And there are so many corrupt, selfish narratives floating around that are creating the culture we're in. There is a lot of failed economics. I wrote once in an article, I think it was The Economics of Happiness, where I said, more people would rather fund a stranger startup than pay for diapers and daycare. Because those things are completely unaffordable. At least you can control what you contribute as an investment. And it's become too expensive. And for a lot of policy choices that we've made. And those policy choices, some of them are corrupt and others are driven by bad cultural narratives. And I'll get into those in a future episode just because I'm running late. And there's also technological pacification. And this is something I wrote about in my first book, A Conovation. That's what happened to Japan. Japan stopped procreating. And a lot of European countries are following them. You know, when you get to a certain level of advancement and you're able to live a very comfortable life, a very selfish life, and entertain yourself, you could watch Netflix for a long time and then Hulu and then, you know, all these other services. You'll never run out of content. You'll never run out of video games. You'll never run out of levels on video games. And that world can really suck you in and steal life away from you. And I fear that that's happening. And they came out with all the different reasons that youth, you know, better things they have to do than try to find a date or a meaningful relationship. One is have more important priorities. Second is just like being single. And third is too busy. And fourth is haven't had luck. And fifth was feel like no one would be interested. We've got some serious depression issues. We've got some serious, you know, just to talk about these poisonous narratives. One of those poisonous narratives is that happiness can be found in the boardroom or in careers in general. It cannot. And I've written a lot about this. Maybe I'll post some links under this. But happiness cannot be found in those places. And I hope the people who are looking for it there discover other people, because that's realistically the only place left where happiness still resides. This is just a quick tip. These are the different authors, famous authors, and the reading level at which they write. So you have to have a fourth grade education to read Ernest Hemingway. J.K. Rowling jumps up to sixth grade. Leo Tolstoy, eighth grade. New York Times, 8th grade. Daniel Kahneman, 10th grade. Susan Cain, I'm so poorly read, I don't even know who she is. She's 11th grade. The Economist is 12th grade. So the reality is, you got to dumb it down. Just as a theme for this whole episode, dumb it down. And not because you're condescending, but because you want to reach more people. You want to have clarity of communication. And that's why I'm doing more podcasts and more videos than I'm doing writing. Because the reality is, this is how people consume information. So you need to connect with them in this kind of way. So at the very least, shorter sentences, shorter paragraphs, and more common words. And there's a great app online called Hemingway App, which everyone should check out. You can paste your writing in and it'll tell you what your grade level score is. And then you can make adjustments. It shows you the adjustments. Really worth doing. But just as we're getting to a point where society is starting to split and so many people are just at odds with each other for no good reason, really, over COVID. I mean, the action steps should be clear, but we're fighting over a disease or the actions of a disease. Anyway, clarity in communication is more important than ever. So I encourage people to really think about that. And there's been a lot of talk about the post office. I mailed my driver's license renewal on Monday, and then it arrived in Somalia this morning, and now I have my own pirate ship. What's everyone complaining about? Yeah, the post office. I was going to get into that, but I can't tell if people are overblowing it. So the most thoughtful piece I'd read on this, and I'm not sure if this is publicly available or if it's just to his subscribers, but there's a reporter named Matt Taibbi who wrote a great piece about the history of both parties trying to degrade and break down the post office. And it's been one bad thing after another. Now, it doesn't excuse the timing of what's happening now, but it's really worth understanding the history and why their finances are as bad as they are. and also why they have the limitations that they do, and they can't enter some of these things like banking and these other services. So it really makes sense to try to understand. And it's been both parties that have been tearing away at it. And I didn't even know all this. I knew some of it, but Matt Taibbi's piece really opened my eyes. And I suggested a slogan for Biden. Only one man can take DeJoy out of postal work. And DeJoy is the name of the guy who's taking all all the mailboxes down or the sorting machines out, whatever it is. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to be. This is a conversation I had in my head. You wasting your time on Twitter again? No. I'm using it to prepare for my podcast. And what does your podcast prepare you for? Unemployment. All right. On that note, I'm going to end this session. It's technically been exactly an hour with the technical difficulties. And what I'll do is I'm going to continue recording some of these other ones and put them on the Patreon. And there's a bunch of good ones. Anyway, hope you join me next time. And you can check out all the previous episodes on themcfuture.com.